Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world. For this episode, Sarah met up with Charis Kubrin at the 2010 American Society of Criminologists meeting, where they talked about public criminology, culture, and measurement strategies.
Well, here we are. We're live at the 2010 ASC in beautiful San Francisco with Charis Kubrin from GW. And I think we'll just start our conversation with a little bit on what you're doing here this weekend presenting.
Well, I'm presenting three different papers that all have to do with my general interest in neighborhoods and crime, but have different foci. One that I presented today is a paper looks at the relationship at the macro level between immigration and crime. And it's part of a book chapter that I'm doing for an edited volume that Pam Wilcox and Frank Culliner are organizing. Basically, they want to know about new directions in research at the macro level between immigration and crime. So I did a review of the literature, primarily at the neighborhood, but also city and MSA level, looking at how neighborhood processes related to immigration affect neighborhood crime rates, and what are some potential new directions for research in this area. So that was more of a substantive, theoretical, new directions piece. Another paper I'm presenting is a paper done with some colleagues, an urban sociologist, Greg Squires, another criminologist, Graham Owsey, and a geographer from Cal State University Northridge, Steve Graves. And this is building on some prior work related to financial institutions in communities and how they contribute to community crime rates. And we're interested in looking at payday lending. Payday lending has emerged on the scene in the last 15 or so years and has really become a popular method for many for their banking. And this is part of a larger fringe banking service industry that really no one has looked at in terms of its effects on communities. There's been a lot of research done at the individual level looking at how folks who use fringe bankers, payday lenders, what the deleterious impacts are for them. But we were interested in the larger question of how does the presence of payday lenders in neighborhoods perhaps influence neighborhood crime rates, sort of controlling on all the covariates that we know to be correlated with neighborhood crime rates, like poverty and racial composition. And so we chose to focus our analysis on neighborhoods in Seattle, Washington. Washington State has seen an enormous growth in the payday lenders over the last 15 years, and we wanted to know, are those neighborhoods with the highest concentrations of payday lenders also the ones that have the highest crime rates? And we find, in fact, that a connection exists. The presence of payday lending is associated with higher violent and property crime rates. That's after controlling on the usual suspects, the usual neighborhood covariates. Mm-hmm. It's also after addressing the potential for spatial autocorrelation and after dealing with endogeneity. So we run an instrumental variable analysis to sort out causality. And we find that, in fact, yes, those neighborhoods with higher payday lenders have higher crime rates, and we offer a lot of policy implications for that. The paper's forthcoming in Criminology and Public Policy, and not sure if you're all familiar, but there's a lot being debated in Congress right now over payday lenders mm-hmm. and the interest rates that they charge
right.
and how it's causing individuals to be in debt and that sort of thing. So we hope to have a say in some respects in terms of policy outcomes that, or at least have something to say
yeah.
in terms of policy outcomes on that.
That's interesting. How did you connect with the geographer?
Well, so as you know, with doing a lot of neighborhood research, it's mm-hmm. it's hard enough to get crime data
right.
by neighborhoods. And we were very thankful to Ruth Peterson and Lori Crevo, who let us use their data they collected under their NSF grant. So we were able to get crime data for Seattle neighborhoods, of course, census data. But then we thought, well, how do we know where are payday lenders located? How do we understand where they are and situated in their concentration in neighborhoods? And it turns out that Stephen Graves has collected data on payday lenders nationwide and has written some very interesting pieces, obviously not looking at crime, but
right.
looking at payday lenders in the military. And
oh.
so we contacted him about his research, and he said, oh, I'd be happy to collaborate with you And so, yeah, it was great having a geographer on. And again, Greg's an urban sociologist, and me and Graham are criminologists. So it was a nice collaboration in that respect.
Yeah,
each of us had a slightly different perspective to bring to things.
Mm-hmm. And then did you have a third paper you were also presenting?
Yeah, a third paper is with my co-author, a longtime collaborator, Tim Wadsworth. And we've had a long history of publishing on the sort of aggregate studies of suicide. And so this is a paper that's continuing in our line of research, looking at the city-level predictors of suicide rates. I mean, I've always been fascinated with suicide as an aggregate phenomenon and understanding the distribution of suicide across geographic spaces, especially since it seems like such an individualized phenomenon.
Right.
For me, it's more about its spatial patterning. And so what we're interested in this paper is modeling longitudinally the relationship between city-level covariates and suicide rates for whites and blacks, primarily young males. Because if you look at trends in suicide for these two populations, mm-hmm. for young African-American males, trends in suicide rates have been rising over the last couple of decades. And there's been a lot written about this panic over what accounts
right.
for this rise in young male suicide rates for blacks. And even though blacks have lower suicide rates than whites, the trend has been such that it's been increasing. So here we want to try and explore what may be causing, what's going on behind the increase, mm-hmm. what may be causing some of these trends. And we're interested in motivational factors, things like poverty, inequality, those kinds of traditional social integration measures that Durkheim was interested in.
Right.
But we're also interested from more of a public health standpoint, opportunities for committing suicide. I don't think sociologists often consider things like the availability of firearms
right.
and how those things vary across geographic areas. So looking at things like gun availability and how certain cities may have higher rates of gun availability relative to others, and whether that may in fact account for differences in city-level suicide rates.
So really taking account of all the environmental factors.
As many as we can.
Right. And how do you measure things like that?
That's probably the biggest challenge, mm-hmm. is measuring gun availability. There is no national data set that is organized by city that tells us how many people actually own guns.
Right.
And so in a lot of the literature, they use proxies. And the proxies have ranged all over the place. Some people use magazine subscriptions to Guns and Ammo magazine as a proxy for gun availability.
Mm-hmm.
Other people look at more policy kinds of measures that vary across cities in terms of what are the policies available for obtaining a gun and that sort of thing. The idea being those cities that are more lenient with their policy are more likely to have higher rates of gun availability. But mm-hmm. there's actually no measure. Mm-hmm. We use a measure that was developed by David Hemingway and colleagues that involves looking at the proportion of homicides and suicides that involved a gun.
Okay.
And I won't get into all the right. boring methodological issues and challenges mm-hmm. with using a measure that's reflective of that. But in any event, they're all proxies mm-hmm. and they're all not ideal. But at this point in stage, there's no other measure.
Right. But you do what you can.
You do what you can, and then you try and work on it in the next round.
That's it's very interesting hearing. I mean, just using this conference as an example of the range of specific topics that you're working on. For you though, how does it all fit together? I mean, what is the big question?
That's the challenge. is making sure that in some way or another, all of these different projects, each with their own sort of micro-level research questions, fit into a larger agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I guess I've always been interested in aggregate processes. And so looking at how, whether it's at the neighborhood level, the city level, the MSA level, how characteristics of areas, broadly speaking, whether they're financial in terms of payday lending or home mortgage lending, whether they're more social in terms of characteristics of the population, that sort of thing, how these characteristics of areas influence crime rates, and then, of course, theorizing what may account for those relationships. I think that's probably perhaps the most interesting and challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we can document, say, a relationship between immigration and crime, one mm-hmm. that is negative for the most part.
Right.
What accounts for that? Why is it that areas that have higher concentrations of immigrants have lower crime rates? So really the challenge with all of this is moving beyond just documenting these aggregate relationships and to begin to explore the processes, whether they're community level processes or city level processes that account for these relationships.
I know you've written a bit too on the theoretical underpinnings. You have this call for clarity paper. Mm-hmm. And something that struck me when reading that was, you know, that terms are very loaded. And I was wondering if you could just kind of explain to our listeners where that paper came from, what motivated it, and, you know, what the reception to those kind of ideas have been.
That's a great question. Well, I had always been interested in social disorganization theory when I conducted neighborhood-level research. And for the most part, my work in this area had been on testing the theory. And I had sort of done quantitative paper after quantitative paper with regression models. And one day I just stopped and said, wait, I am taking for granted the assumptions of this theory way too much. Let me step back, reacquaint myself with the theory, the historical background, what I think are the issues, and really think about where I would like to see the theory go in terms of methodological new directions and substantive new directions. And I felt like the task was enormous.
Right.
That's why I pulled Rome Weitzer on, my good colleague and friend, as a second author on this paper. We talked about sort of, okay, what, how would one go about thinking? What are the important methodological and substantive new directions for this theory? Because I didn't want to just apply the theory without necessarily thinking, okay, the assumptions that underlie those models. What may be working, what may not be working. And that really was a good lesson in stepping back and thinking about the bigger picture. I mean, these are theories. They're not perfect.
Right.
And I think sometimes we get so wedded to the ideas, and then we don't think outside of those ideas.
Right.
So that was a small exercise in beginning to do that. And it was also an excellent exercise in writing a paper that did not involve analysis, that was non-empirical.
Right. And, I mean, just thinking broadly beyond, you know, this conference or the academic audience, what are the consequences of not stepping back and thinking about these theories and then, you know, having your conclusion and making a policy recommendation? I mean, was that part of your motivation, or is it something you think of?
I mean, I think the perfect example of that right now is what's going on with respect to immigration and crime.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at public perception about immigration and crime, it's that they go hand in hand, that of course areas where more immigrants reside have higher crime rates because immigrants are more crime prone. If you look at the theoretical underpinnings with respect to social disorganization theory on that point, well, of course, Sean McKay assumed that immigrants are disorganizing forces, that they cause residential instability, ethnic heterogeneity, they undermine local institutions. But in fact, we know that that is not the case, that immigrants are much less crime-prone than the native-born, and now we're, with a burgeoning aggregate literature in this area, we're learning that areas that have higher levels of immigrant concentration actually have lower crime rates. So here we have a theory that's making assumptions about immigrants and immigration as a social process that's really not bearing out. And we almost never stop and think, what good do immigrants bring to communities? How do they strengthen informal social control and social ties and networks and that sort of thing? How do they revitalize communities? And I think when you start off with a theory that just right off the bat makes these negative assumptions, you don't tend to think about the counterpoint, which is how might that be, right?
Yeah.
So for me, that's a perfect example of a modification that needs to be made to the theory. And in fact, it has been made. Ramiro Martinez and others have proposed the immigrant revitalization thesis, which reevaluates the role of immigration in community crime rates.
What would you say is the role then of a social scientist who has done all this empirical work and has a theory that maybe goes against the grain of popular opinion? I mean, what can we do? At what level can we insert our work to try to kind of become part of that broader conversation?
Well, the latest issue of Criminology and Public Policy, which I think one of the goals there is to actually talk about how we can make criminology more accessible beyond just academics.
Right.
How do we translate these findings into real life meaning? That's very challenging for an aggregate researcher, because what do these findings mean? And so the question is, even though there's going to be folks that challenge what you have to say, and what your ideas may go against mainstream society, you have to get a story out there. You have to get stories out there. For every story, the example I was thinking about with Chris Eugen, he said, for every story that you hear about an ex-felon that fails, right, that gets back sent back to prison, we need a story to hear about how they succeed, right? And I think what we have in the media is plenty of negative stories. What we don't have is positive stories. We don't have stories about how communities are better because immigrants have moved there and are revitalizing the community. Mm-hmm. We don't have stories that, talk about successes. So we need to have those stories. Mm-hmm. I think that's one important component that should be addressed.
Yeah. Not to completely switch gears, but we were talking about, your work. It comes from a lot of different angles, and you also do some culture, and especially with your studies on music. And I think our listeners would be excited to hear about that, because it's quite different, but it's a really interesting couple pieces. So maybe you could just explain, again, where that came from.
Sure. And the history of that, I teach a graduate level race, ethnicity, and crime course, which I love teaching. And we use a lot of the ethnographic work, literature done, books by like Elijah Anderson, Code of the Street, and others who look at inner city youth culture and crime. And what was interesting is one of my students one day said, "Charis, this literature is all great, but what's kind of missing from it is hip hop and rap music."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a personally a big fan of hip-hop music, so I was actually annoyed that I hadn't discovered that myself.
So you need grad students around, right?
They always said teaching informs research and research informs teaching, but there was the perfect example of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a really excellent point.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that we're talking about inner-city youth culture? We're on the ground dealing with youth in these very violent communities, and rap music is not having some role in this discussion. And
right.
When I actually went through and read some of that ethnographic literature, great though it is, there was absolutely no discussion for the role of music.
Hmm.
Now, there's all this literature, sociological literature on music and culture, but it wasn't informing this ethnographic literature, and this ethnographic literature wasn't informing this sociology of music literature. And so I thought, here's the perfect opportunity to bring these things together. So even though this seems like completely outside of my area,
mm-hmm.
I am interested in, at the community level,
right.
things like race, ethnicity, culture, violence,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the question that I had after reading The Street Code and discussing it with my students was, well, to what extent is The Street Code present not only in the street, but in the music
mm-hmm.
that these youth listen to? And what does it mean for them? And how does it either reinforce or challenge or make them think about their own self-perception, whether we're talking about issues of masculinity or their behavior, such
mm-hmm.
as violence?
Right.
And so that got me going when I actually started reading the literature on hip-hop and rap music to see how it might relate back to these things.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised to see that most of the studies were non-empirical, more thought pieces.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, before I go too far, I think I need to step back and do a real true content analysis
mm-hmm.
to understand what is it.
Get your baseline.
Get your baseline to see what really is happening in this music.
Mm-hmm.
And how do the themes in a lot of this ethnographic literature play out in the music? And how are they different from, and how can we look at the two in terms of the music, the street code in the music, and the street code in the street, if
mm-hmm.
you will, and how can they inform each other? So
right.
that was what really got me started that way.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it does kind of fit into our larger conversation, because it's another way to sort of explore these things, but in a more accessible discourse,
mm-hmm.
I think, for some people.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it was really. I learned a lot going through
mm-hmm.
the songs of these rappers. I mean, I did a content analysis of over 400 songs. The issue is, of course, this is just one component of the music process for these youth. I mean, what does the music mean to them?
Mm-hmm.
They listen to a rapper like Jay-Z. They listen to a rapper, back in the early 90s, Biggie Smalls, Tupac. These lyrics say X.
Mm-hmm.
A male youth from a disadvantaged community with this family background, what do these lyrics mean, and how do they differ, say, from a middle-class white girl raised in the suburbs, you know, who has a very different life experience. So I think it was great to do the content analysis and understand how these, what these themes are saying in the music, but I think the next step really, and this is what I'm engaged in, is moving beyond just the content analysis, going into communities, speaking with youth from varied backgrounds to see what the music means. Because I think there's an assumption that, that the music exists and it is taken in.
Right.
And in fact, we're active listeners and we accept some things and disregard others. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I want to get more at that.
Yeah, that's interesting because it is, there's such a broad mass appeal, especially over the last 10 years with hip-hop music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to assume that it's only relative to,
yeah,
you know, people in certain communities or in urban environments or something like that. But, I mean, it's ubiquitous now.
Well, now you have with the complete commercialization of the music.
Exactly.
That extra market force in there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a paper Ron Weitzer and I recently completed, published in Men and Masculinities, looking at misogyny and violence in rap music. And what we try and do in that paper is first document the various forms of misogyny that exist in rap music. But then I think, and this is more interesting, theorize on three different levels why misogyny takes the forms that it does in rap music. So, for example, one of the themes that we found that was prevalent in the music in terms of misogyny was themes about pimping and prostitution. What is it? Why does misogyny take that form in the music?
Mm-hmm.
And how can that be linked to, say, the local conditions or the neighborhoods where rappers come from?
Yeah.
The global forces of gender inequality that exist more broadly, and then the market forces of pressures to produce music that highlights those themes.
Yes.
So disentangling all those forces, I think, is a very big challenge, but one that's really interesting.
It is. It's very interesting.
Because that's the thing about rap music. It's very global, but it's also very local. Mm-hmm. Rappers are very tied to the communities that they come from. The music is extremely unique to the areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's commonalities, but there's also geographical entities, geographical boundaries that, that delineate different forms of rap music. So
that is so interesting. Well, so, you know, looking forward, what questions are still lingering out there for you? And if not ones that you specifically in the next, you know, 10 years want to answer, that you'd like to see, you know, our field answer?
Oh my gosh.
It's a big question, but I mean, especially, I mean, we're talking about how things that you, that people have studied have been changing quickly and how all that fits together. I mean, what would you like to see happen next?
That's, I think the things that I struggle with in my own research are issues regardless of what area of research you do.
Mm-hmm.
As a macro level researcher, what frustrates me is a very little understanding about process. So as I mentioned before, I can, you know, I can document that payday lending is associated with crime rates. But the more interesting question is through what mechanisms and why? I mean, that's really where, I mean, you just take the simple correlation of poverty and crime. I could name five criminological theories that would account for that association.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Why is it? Okay, and first of all, I could even challenge that, in fact, poverty and crime are truly associated, right? It depends on what crimes we're talking about and that sort of thing. Are we talking about official data or self-report data? Those issues aside, what does it mean to say poverty and crime are associated or immigration and crime are not associated or are negatively associated? I feel frustrated by not being able to understand those mechanisms, identify and measure those mechanisms. And that's partly a function of working with aggregate data, partly a function of doing quantitative analyses, and partly a function of challenges with theory testing in these areas. I mean, how does one test the myriad of theories that may be related at neighborhood, city, MSA levels? So for me, I think I'm becoming much more interested in identifying those processes, the why questions. And so if that involves sort of getting on the ground and speaking with youth with the rap thing, with the rap project, or using more qualitative data to better understand what's going on in communities that have high concentrations of immigrants, why in fact they have lower crime rates. And I think those are important directions that we need to go in. Thank you.
The ASC meetings are over, and now so too is this episode of Office Hours. Thanks to Sarah and Sharis for taking time out of their busy conference schedule for our humble little podcast. And thanks to Jesse, Arturo, Chris, Doug, Letta, and the whole crew in Minnesota. See you soon.